A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Hi everyone, I'm Andrew Kitley. Please join me for brand new episodes on my podcast, The Invisible Gift, the show about turning neurodiversity into possibility. Last week on the show, I met Lee Chambers, entrepreneur and motivational speaker. In the episode, Lee opened up about the illness that made him bedridden for a year and why it changed his perspective on life. Lee and I also discussed the mental health struggles founders can encounter and why diversity is the future. It's a great episode, so make sure you check it out. On today's podcast, I'm joined by entrepreneur and founder of Full Spectrum, Andre Skeppel. Full Spectrum is a really exciting company that aims to modernize and personalize education, care, and health using technology. As Andre is dyslexic, dyspraxic, and has some elements of ADHD, the business was founded because Andre didn't believe that the education system offered him enough support, and he wants to change that for the next generation coming up. In today's show, Andre details what Full Spectrum is and what they want to achieve. We also discuss the massive problem with education today and why the government needs to step up and scrap the old way of doing things. But first, let's learn a bit more about Andre and what he's all about from the man himself. So tell me a bit about yourself. Introduce yourself to the audience.
So a pleasure to me. My name is Andre Skeppel. I'm founder and CEO of a very exciting and very thought-provoking technology company called Full Spectrum. In short, the company I formed, we're utilizing technology and innovation to quite literally create a new curriculum. And the curriculum that we would like, or would like to be more accurate to the needs and the expectations of children, young people in education, to be inclusive to the different types of personalities and the different neurodivergences that are out there, to be measurable, so we'll be able to track and monitor and use that information to be more data-driven, just how we can plug and play the right types of courses and interventions and the personal support that's needed to fill those needs. And then finally, as with anything, it needs to be sustainable. So how do we use data? How do we use all this information and this ecosystem that's been formed to ensure that whenever we actually are plugging and playing in various different elements of education, health, or social care support for young people, it's done at a targeted point, at a point of discovery, and it's not a case of just, doing things and waste money. It has to have some sort of cycle economy that makes it more sustainable, so that it's not just for select people, it's for everyone. That's what we do.
Holy crap. there's right work into that. So who is the person that consumes that? Who's the person you're trying? So who's the person you're selling that?
So this is where when we try and talk about Full Spectrum, I do a lot of pitches. I do a lot of conversations where traditionally they get you to explain it in 1 minute or 5 minutes, and because this is an area that has a growing complexity, there's very much layers of it, and also in terms of the consumer model of this type of solution, is not focused to one person. And I think this is where we're quite disruptive or quite radical in our approach. The consumer is an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is that when you look at it in terms of how society is made up, where you've got, schools, you've got the NHS, you've got also private clinics, you've got, therapists and psychologists, you've got all these people. And then you've got the parents and the carers, you've got residential homes, you've got, education centers, you've got all these different elements that make up this framework that provides some level of support in learning and development. Mm-hmm. The problem is that whenever we think of education or think of the curriculum as it is, we always think of, oh, it's got to be one individual. There's got to be one player in this whole, whole paradigm that constructs this. The thing is, education as a concept, since the dawn of civilization, has always been collaborative. Mm-hmm. It's always been an ensemble of individuals differing in experiences, in thought processes, in professions to do that. You heard that saying, it takes a village to raise a child, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, we've taken that concept, that phrase that we use quite frequently, and quite literally say, well, this is our audience, this is our consumer base. And so, in short, our solution is designed and developed for local government. It's designed and developed for schools and Monmouth County Trusts. It's designed and developed for NHS, individual trusts, integrated commissioning boards, private sector. It's basically built for quite literally everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where a lot of people struggle to think, well, it's kind of overambitious. And so, well, so what? It is overambitious because this is an area that can actually take us from here to here. You look at the UK, for example, you know, post-Brexit, people we're talking about, there's a brain drain. You've got a whole bunch of talented people that came from Europe, from other countries around the world that came to the UK to incubate and to collaborate with their brilliance, and they all just sold it off. How are you going to make up that gap, the deficit? You've got to look at it in terms of what exists right now. So you've got this population of children, young people, including myself being an virgin, right? So if you look at my story is this. I started walking and talking quite late when I was around 2 years old. My development itself was so delayed that they put me into a nursery filled with children with learning disabilities. So you're talking about children that had severe disabilities such as cerebral palsy, you know, brain injury, all those things there. And so I was in that type of environment. And then, but at the same time, I was able to read. I was able to show some signs of communication. And all of a sudden, when I turned two, three years old, developed. I'm like, oh, what's happened there? Did a test, did some assessments, put me straight back into a mainstream nursery, the IQ test, and said, oh, your IQ is 120. You actually need to be in this type of situation. But then I had a speech and language delay. So all these, that story in particular, it's like, okay, well, something happened, wasn't picked up. Now, going through primary school, did well, increasing well. Going through secondary school, did well. I was expected to go and study medicine at one of the top, like, Russell Group universities. My goal was to study medicine either at Imperial College or at Cambridge. And so I went to one of the top six from colleges in South London. And I failed at all my A-levels. And I didn't understand why, because I tried to, it wasn't the one I was trying. I really wanted to work hard. I wanted to bring that pride and that success to my parents, to my family, and something that was instilled in me from my community from 5 years old. But I just couldn't get through the hurdle. I had to retake my A-levels like three times until I eventually got into university through a different degree program that had relaxed laws. And I was diagnosed at 21. Now, the point when I realized that something was potentially, there was an issue in terms of how I approached my education, because there was an inexplicable drop off in my attainment. It took 5 years from that point to get diagnosed. Now, the point of that diagnosis now is that, okay, that diagnosis wasn't just from one assessment. I had to go to this place and then that place and that place. That all these people kind of said, oh, we've got to work with you. The reason why it took so long and it still was incorrect was because it was very disjointed. So when our system is approached to this whole ecosystem concept, it's because we saw the issues of how fragmented and disjointed this whole architecture of, you know, alternative provision is, and said to myself, okay, cool. Well, it's not, the problem isn't in one place. The problem is every fucking where. Like, you've got to have a solution that can plug all these holes, but not only plug these holes, bring that single point of truth by integrating education, health, social care, all those elements in one portal. It's quite literally to take that concept of it takes a village to raise a child in the 21st century. So it's a very long-winded way to answer your question to say the consumer is progressively everyone.
Yeah, no, I think you answered the question well. I've got to admit, when you first explained it, I didn't really understand it. But so you're trying to change, just digging into it deeper, I now get who you're targeting. What are the facilities, the services, the products? What is it you're actually offering?
So the company offers a solution that kind of unfolds and kind of evolves the more we work with the client, in the loosest term. So we've got this platform that we call FS1, Full Spectrum One. It's what we call a support intelligence platform. And for us to design any type of business intelligence, artificial intelligence, anything like that, you need data. You need to work with the clients, the organizations, the individuals that have a certain process of doing things. And it's not a case of just throwing tech and say, oh, here you go, you figure out how it works and so forth. In terms of that, tech tends to have quite a high churn. So if you can't apply the tool and it's not fulfilling the purpose, you're not going to use it. And if it's a tool that's based on a model of subscription or anything like that, if you're not getting value, it's going to drop off. You're not actually solving a problem. You're just here to space. And this is what a lot of people in tech unfortunately do. They just build things out of their own, you know, presumptive approach.
Yeah.
And not really understand the issues or the perspectives of their user base. So what we do is say, all right, cool. We built this system, we built this platform, we built this technology off the research that we've done over the past 3.5 years. And the research we've done is based on interviewing, testing, iterating up to a certain point. Mm. Now we've got a concept. We've got a concept that we need to prove. We as consultants then go and work with schools, go and work with councils, with the NHS, with private organizations. And essentially what we do is, as thought leaders, as a think tank, we understand their problems, we understand their concerns, we understand the pains and also the gains that could be projected with the implementation of our technology, and then really sit down with them and actually redesign their pathways to support and development. And through the redesigning their pathways, the simple focus is, how do we make your life easier by using that technology? How do we help you to either improve or scale up your services and save money by doing so by using that technology? And most importantly, how do we get your service, or how do we get your intervention to provide maximum impact to a child, a young person, a neurodivergent individual with regards to their learning and development? Mm-hmm. How do we make it outcomes focused and process driven or data driven? And so we do that first as a service to all those different types of organizations that make up our client base. And then once we've actually gone through that stage of discovery, system configuration, and then eventually solution implementation, then we then switch to a traditional SaaS model, software as a service model, where the platform switched on, we bill them, you know, monthly or quarterly, whatever. And then the system is customized to the needs of the individual. But there's one thing, and a lot of people get kind of frightened when they say, oh wow, so is it basically a lot of bespoking of the system? We say no. This is not a market that exists. We are creating a market. Mm-hmm. So anything we do right now has an element of bespokeness to it, but it won't be bespoked for long. We actually are literally creating something out of nothing.
Yeah.
So what we do whilst the platform, the concept is being proven and matures and evolves to something that becomes gold standard, what we intend to do is to standardize all those requirements, all those pathways, all those mechanisms of intervention that all need to be digitally transformed into that single point of truth that can be replicated in every single setting to form these ecosystems, so that it's constant and it's standardized, you know, and therefore you've got that universal benefit by having a universal system.
So really you're creating a new industry.
Yep.
Through an agile model.
Essentially, yeah. And it has to,
it's clever.
It's what is required to solve a multi-layered complexity of fuck-ups that this country and many other countries as well, because it's not just England or the UK that has this problem. This problem is consistent worldwide. It's just that the main issue is, and I was speaking to people, we're exhibiting at a specialist show for special educational needs. And there were so many people, like teachers in particular, came to our stand and we showed them our prototype and explained what we're trying to do. And the frustrations was, how is it I can have an app that can track and monitor when my parcel arrives? Or I can have an app that can track and monitor how much I'm spending or how much my savings are working? Or, you know what I mean? All these elements of intelligence that I've applied in all these other industries by education. Yeah. And yet education is one of the most critical foundations of society that is left neglected and decayed, because those that set the parameters and the policies of this particular industry basically do it from a state of entitlement and ignorance. They say, well, it works for me, then it should work for everybody else. And if it doesn't work for those people that don't meet the status quo, then they're pretty much put in a bin. And this is the reasons why, if you look at the root cause to why young people, there's growing numbers of young people that are in criminality, that are being groomed by gangs and entering gangs, they're doing county lines. Mm. There's essentially a schools to prisons pipeline.
Yeah.
The root cause of all that chaos that's happening with young people and the problems happening in our generation as well is because those young people were disengaged in education. Mm-hmm. And the disengagement in education is because the curriculum, the framework, the way it has been applied to them mm-hmm. has not been fit to them. Mm-hmm. A child has to adapt to the status quo of the curriculum, not the curriculum to adapt to the requirements of the child. So if we're doing that code switch and say, look, the child, the individual needs to come first. They're the ones that dictate the curriculum. We now need to put together the right types of tools and implementations and pathways and mechanisms that keep them in relative control. And we know, as this village around them, our part to play to ensure that the one focus that we need to ensure is those outcomes have been achieved.
That's beautiful. And I'll tell you why. Because I get tired from explaining to people that we're trying to raise new generations on old systems that haven't worked, not even for a short amount of time, haven't worked for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And on this podcast, we've got to the point where we talk about education and then we go, well, it's too hard, too big to move. And actually, what you're saying is true. What you've done, and I love it, is you take modern way of thinking and gone, fuck it, let's scrap the old way of doing it. It doesn't work. Let's look at it from a point of view. And one thing we've learned over the years in tech, that data does matter. That is a key component.
It's the new oil. It's the new commodity that's going around.
How can you know how to change something until you understand what the problems are? Exactly. And that can only be achieved by data and information. And yet you're right, we've got all these things in our life that make the world easier and better and bespoke for everyone in a way, but our education system don't. And one of the big problems for me, I've started supporting I'm from Croydon originally. I started supporting a local youth club because I'm big into youth clubs. They changed my life. I could have easily led down the wrong way. Most people I grew up with are heroin addicts now, and all sort of problems, and it's very sad to see. But if it weren't for that youth club, I would be in a very different situation. So I'm very supportive of that. And that school to prison is exactly how I see it. Yep. And it's so sad because when I think about people in prison, I think of entrepreneurs and people that could really change the world.
Absolutely.
And people judge so heavily these people when you're right, it's disengagement at the school level. Mm. It starts there, right? And I just, so for me, I love that, but how are you going to go about changing the people that you're right? When you said the government is ignorance, my God, man, that is so true because you don't change things that you think work because people are ignorant, right? So how are we going to change the school system in that way?
We've attempted, I've attempted to contact the Department for Education a number of times over the past 3 years to say to them that, look, there's an issue with regards to special education needs and the type provision. There's an issue with regards to the curriculum that there's a growing number of young people and children that are being disengaged because of the how antiquated the curriculum is, how antiquated the process is. It's too process-driven and not outcomes-focused. We have a solution that we've designed that we would love to have a conversation. And I've contacted them multiple times. I've been fobbed off so many times. And the reason why I contacted them and I felt passionate to contact them is because, so I'm originally from South London myself, but then I also lived in Harlow for about 5 years. And my local MP was Robert Halfen. Robert Halfen's also the chairman of the Education Committee for House of Commons. So when I wrote to him and said to him, I've designed a solution that is focused on improving special needs and the type provision. Because he's been an advocate for the reforms in this area, he's like, oh, I'm actually quite interested to learn more. Come and meet me in a surgery and so forth, and then we'll have a chat. We presented this solution to him in, what was it, 2019? Mm. And at the time, they were just about to publish the Select Committee's report with regards to the issues of special needs and type provision. And this was their report as a recommendation to the government to consider these reforms because of what they could see was a crisis point has been reached. The shit is quite literally about to hit the fan. And Ofsted then said the same thing. Now, 3 years later, the government released a paper called the Senn Review Green Paper in April 2022. Mm-hmm. And in this paper, in a nutshell, they basically admitted that the whole framework of special needs autonomy provisions at crisis point, the mechanism, the support, the policies are not the different value. It is very acrimonious of a situation between parents and councils and parents and schools and councils. Everyone's pissed off because of how broken and how bureaucratic the system is. And it's essentially a postcode lottery. So if you're lucky to live in a certain area, you may get the right type of support and help. Mm-hmm. But then those who live in the wrong area, and quite frankly, it's the areas that we probably grew up, they mm-hmm. don't have that support, you are essentially fucked. You're not going to get that support itself. So what they're saying is that there need to be reforms that look at a standardized system across the country. They need to look at in terms of how we can improve engagement between the parent and the professionals, so it becomes much more of a co-production collaborative environment as opposed to an acrimonious one that's based on just the parents suing the council because they're not doing anything. In fact, here's some interesting figures. More than £1 billion. There was more than £1 billion of a black hole in the public purse that hasn't even been reported in the wide scales yet, that the Asian Treasury discovered earlier this year. And the Asian Treasury discovered this private hole because all the councils, because there's a lack of integration with data, they weren't reporting the bottom line in the balance sheets of how they fucked up the special needs and the support and getting sued left, right and centre. And so they forced the DfE to do something about it. It's like, look, the special needs is draining the public purse. We're running out of money as it is because of the central fuck-up that is Brexit and everything else that's happened. Do something about it. And last year, £55 million was spent by councils, by parents that have sued them. And the hit rate for a parent taking their council to tribunal is 95%. Mm. So you're telling me 95 out of 100 times you're going to get paid because the council have basically mismanaged their plan. So the whole situation is absolute mazzers. Like, so they said, we're going to make these changes. These changes are going to come. And they commissioned £85 million project for consulting firms or consulting consortiums to go and actually identify what the issue is and then report the findings to the DfE. We actually tried to bid with for one of those, and the bid wasn't even looked at properly. It just went to a consortium that basically, what we believe, said, oh, if we don't actually do a good job, you'd have to pay us. So very naive procurement exercise. Mm-hmm. So we went back to the DfE another time and said, okay, cool. We have, I brought with me today as well, we basically wrote an ebook that basically took their proposals, which is 126 fucking pages. And it's like, look, who's looking at the time to read 126 pages? Mm-hmm. Let's just digest it. Let's do a very streamlined summary, but also just talk about in terms of how we can actually provide solutions in all these areas of concern and the proposals that they submit. And so we published this book, ebook. Mm-hmm. We actually sent the DfE a copy of this and said, we've taken what you've wrote and we've simplified it and we've shown what we can do. Oh, and by the way, here's some proposals in terms of the solution that we designed. They then said, oh, this actually looks really interesting. And then 8 policymakers were CC'd an email. They said, oh, can we meet? Yeah, sure. They set up a meeting within 3 days that was scheduled for 2 weeks. This is a department that I've been trying to contact for 3 years with no luck. And all of a sudden, I then, as a team, we developed this document and sent it to them. They've read it. I'm like, oh, actually, no, we do need to listen to you. Why didn't you listen to us 3 years ago? Why didn't you listen to us earlier this year? Why didn't you look at our bid when we went to say, look, we've got a bid that we can actually go and assess the whole country and come with a solution? You know what? We've not only designed a solution, we've built it. Yeah. We've done it. You don't need to think. You don't need to wait to be advised. We've got something that we've tested across the country and everyone's saying that this is mustard. We need this now. This is solving our problems. So what you need to do now is don't think. Don't think. Stop thinking. Act. Do. We have the solution, but also we have the strategy. Why don't you take us on board as the thought leaders? You know what they said? This is the only solution that's ever been suggested to them that exists that actually meets the criteria of the reforms. So now the plan is we are trying to emerge ourselves as the thought leaders in SEND and basically say, yeah, you know what? You can support us. We can go a lot further, faster, better, with less risk. But we're not going to wait for you. We're going to set up. So now I've been speaking to a number of multi-economy trusts with councils we're working with, colleges, and essentially we're assembling what could be the largest digital transformation project in British history, where all of those agencies, all those organizations are basically saying, we've had enough, we want a new curriculum, we're going to work with Full Spectrum, and we're going to show what should be done and take to the DfE and say, see.
I think, I mean, there is loads to get into there. And I think it's quite funny. I think it's a simple answer to that question, which is, it goes back to Henry Ford saying, if people asked me what they actually wanted, they would have said faster horses.
Yep.
And then he invented the car. The thing is, I think what you're doing, people don't know, so they don't understand it. And actually, you say about my biggest issue there, what cries to me from someone with experience, from talking to lots of people, is the reason why they didn't read your report is because in anywhere, especially when you deal with government, you've got to be connected in some way. Exactly. You've got to have a name that people recognise, because what they don't want, they don't want the boat to be rocked too much. And what you're doing is coming in as a fresh face in the industry and with an idea that it all comes down to risk, right? For them, they're like, oh, we could get them in, they could do amazing, but there's also big risk for us, right? And this is the problem with government. They're too worried about how they look, their party looks, how they're dealing with stuff, so they don't bother. It's easier to just get by than it is to make big changes. What you're saying, it sounds unbelievably exciting, right? And you sending that thinging is exactly how I have to do my business. When I tell people, when they hear things, they don't care. When they see things, that's when things really start happening. But, I mean, kudos to you, because you've gone for the next step, which most people struggle with. We all know. I always say, do you know what? If I had a Sir Andrew Kitley, I'd get in a lot more places a lot easier, right? It's your connections to it. And I think, like you say, the problem is this is so new. They know. Everyone knows education has to change. Everyone. And I think parents are getting sick of it. Teachers are getting more sick of it, of everything else. But you're right. It's not just about schools. It's about every aspect.
Precisely.
And what's really interesting here is I had a guy on from Amazon Web Services, and we was having a conversation. And it's not just him. I speak to other people in the tech industry. And they were saying that generally, that most countries, particularly America, because of the kind of tech infrastructure, are looking at pulling their tech companies out of the UK because the skill shortage here is far too high. And this is a huge, ridiculous problem for us that we need to solve. And our education at the moment does not push people into them different ways. I trialed it. So I went to a school and said, you know, what do you want to do when you're older? And no one... The answer, they put IT in it. They say IT, and it's this huge thing inside the term IT, and most people at school don't know what that entails. They think that's sitting in front of a computer in a booth typing stuff that's not important, because that's what they learn at school, right? They might do a bit of design and stuff, but actually all the amazing stuff we need as a civilization now is in that box.
Yeah.
And we have got a really big problem on the horizon. Now, you say about Brexit and losing all the key stuff. I know that pain, because as much as I will get shot for saying this, my best engineers are Eastern Europeans. The education system in there are amazing.
Yep.
Actually, in most places, like most Spanish people I interview, have the levels of maths they do at school are equivalent to what we do in university and stuff like that. So they come in and their understanding of engineering is so much better, not than everyone, but just generally the standard is better, and their work ethic is a lot better as well. And obviously in the construction industry, they've been talking about the problem with Brexit and the school shortage, and it's so big at the moment that no one's talking about it. It is such a problem that it's going to desecrate the UK. But most people kind of knew that was going to happen anyway. But that is a big problem. And what you're saying now is true. If we don't sort something out now, we are in trouble. And the problem I see is, you've answered the question on how you're going to get the change, but the problem is, I find with government, do you find that the the time, the turnaround time on these things are so big.
Oh,
it's like moving mountains, right?
Listen, it's like, if I could give a very brutal assessment or even like a metaphor to explain my journey in terms of trying to penetrate local government, let alone national government, it's like literally hitting your head against the wall with the prospect of making a crack. The crack was made last week, but it's left a massive bruise. And I'm just like, holy shit. I got to try and figure out in terms of how I can actually...
And it's resealed.
It's resealed. And then it's like, you got to do it. But you know what? You sit down and you're like, yeah, I'm in a crack, but the wall's not broken yet. So you got to keep doing it. So I think the issue is that, and this is from my perspective, my personal perspective, those that work in local government, by and large, do not have that quintessential passion for change. It is a job for them. It gives them significant security. I know this because my former partner, my child's mother, works for local government. I've seen her work in multiple roles in local government. It's her job. It is a job, and it gives them more security. And you know what? If I don't like it here, I can apply and go to another one, which tends to happen. So what you find is that when you take these types of disruptive solutions to local government, you get an ensemble cast of one person who absolutely loves it, has a passion for change, who really is empathetic and wants to make things move. Unfortunately, that person is a decision maker, and that person has very little influence. They're there to open the doors and to introduce you to the people who have the influence, the bureaucracy. That triangle, that pyramid itself is a stranglehold, because the higher you go up the pyramid itself, you either find people who are just like, yeah, but it's money. I don't get it. I've got so much problems. You know what? I'm probably going to get sacked at some point soon. I'm going to just jump ship and go try something else. Yeah. So it never really moves forward. And the amount of times I've spoken to councils, and we've impressed them with the proposals, we've impressed them in terms of the vision and what we want. And there's people in those conversations who quite literally want to advocate that change. They want to work with us because, not just because of their approach, but the passion and the credibility within that passion that matches their intentions. And then it stops. So the turnaround time is so remarkably long. But you could then, on the upside, say, well, it's like the equivalent of the gestation of a baby elephant. It takes a long time, it's long, it's arduous, and it's a painful process, but you know what, something beautiful comes out of it. Mm. And I think for us, we have to, as a company, a young company that's underfunded, we're constantly raising, we have difficulty raising because we can't be benchmarked to anybody else because we are the market, we're creating a market and radicalizing it in that way. We have to look at in terms of multiple strategies that we can exist. So you've got one strategy that's focused on government. The bureaucratic element is going to take either a long cycle, or you've got to basically say, look, fuck it, let's do it for free. Let's just say, look, let's just take a hit. Let's just show it working. And then once we've proven that market, that traction, that credibility, we can then influence the market to tender and all these things there. The other side, the other strategy, and this is a strategy we're focusing on now, is to say, okay, we just need to bring on board game changers. We need to bring on board those who have the appetite for change, the trailblazers, and go to them and say, yo, like, we want to create this new curriculum. We can make the decisions, but you've got to get the funding for us, but we can do it. So this is what we're doing now. We're literally saying, all right, cool, we can work with the councils. That's going to be slow. We're going to work with the schools, work with the independent schools, the economy trust that can move quick, and say, yo, let's not wait for the government to tell you what to do. Let's just do it. Let's just lead the way. And by showing, by having an example and having the evidence of change, take them and say, you have, and we know now, you have no other option. Because I tell you this, you might find another company that might try and do what we do. We've already saw this as an opportunity and say, look, we're now going to look at IP protecting the whole thing, not just solution, not just the code, not just the designs, the whole entire concept as a niche area. So it's like what Thanos says. The inevitability always returns to me. It always returns to us. That is essentially what we said to DfE.
I totally agree with Andre here. The government has been too slow to enact change. The world has changed so much, even in the last 5 years. If we want to have the next generation ready for the future, we need to stop living in the past.
Hi everyone, I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
Coming up on the podcast, Andre and I talk about why people in power are resistant to change, and Andre makes a powerful statement on what he would say to the people in 10 Downing Street. But first, I ask Andre, why are we not using data and modern tech to revolutionise the way we teach and provide care? We have social media platforms and search engines that use our data to create bespoke advertising for us, which is actually unreal. Most people these days go, my phone's definitely listening to me. Maybe it is. But also the adverts, it's like, I'm thinking about doing this and it appears.
Yes, exactly.
And the thing is, I don't think we realise as humans, we are very predictable when you have the correct data.
Correct.
And what the thing is, organisation out there have nailed it. It's already out there. The tech is out there and the solutions are out there. But we use it, they use it for sales, which is great for them. Brilliant. But why don't we use it in situations like that, what you're saying? To have, if you've got one Zen person sitting there working it all out. Sorry, Zen. That's it. Yep. I'm terrible at that stuff. even though I'm in schools all the time. So you've got the person sitting there. And actually, if you see the data of how the child interacts with certain things, you can predict so much. And like you say,
you can model it.
You can, yes. And it will be so accurate compared to the model we have at the moment that actually it's almost stupid that we don't already do that.
But there's a reason why we don't do that. And again, from my perspective, the reason why we don't do that is because until now, no one cared to do that. And I think this is where, and I say this with no ego, companies like ours exist because we are neurodivergent. We are, as a survival technique, I always have to think out of labyrinths. I always have to problem solve. I always have to think from different perspectives, different dimensions, different, you know what I mean, paradigms to solve problems. I've taken this solution, I've explained this solution to some of the best experts in the country. They say, it's amazing, it's brilliant, it's groundbreaking, you're a genius. I'm like, really? It's common sense.
Yeah.
It's common sense. I've basically taken, I come from a biotech background. I've come and I've disrupted all these different, projects and research proposals and all these things there that are used in medicine, they're used in life science research. And all these different philosophies exist. They haven't been put into education because, as I said earlier, you got old, dusty people that run the policies for education and integrated care that just don't think of the future. They don't understand. They just think of, let me show you the quintessential reasons why the national curriculum exists, how it exists. The national curriculum was created in the 1800s. It's created during the Bronze Age. Mm. The national curriculum was created for the sole purpose to bring an entire population of young boys to get them into working in manufacturing factories.
Yep.
This is the reasons why the classrooms, traditionally, when we grew up, they're in grids like that because they're meant to resemble a production facility in a factory, whether it's textiles, whether if it's in metalwork, whatever. That framework still exists 200 years later.
Yep.
And the wickedest thing is that the UK have outsourced all the manufacturing.
Yeah, I know.
What has been built here? Yeah. Really, what has been built here? You go to places like Dudley, you go to, you go to the East Coast and all those things there, you know, you've got this constant conversation about, you know, the fossil fuel conundrum where everything is exported, or imported, I should say, from other countries. We've exported the one thing that this curriculum was centered on.
Yeah.
And we are priding ourselves as a country, as a nation, Royal Britannia, it's all focused on services. Intelligence.
Yeah.
But that intelligence is not cultivated in the curriculum. Mm. So what we're saying is that if you really want an industry, if you really want your GDP, your growth, to focus on the service industries, focus on problem solving, innovation, intelligence, you need a curriculum that nurtures intelligence. You need a curriculum that nurtures the gig economy, digital, freedom of thought, neurodiversity. You have to have it neurodivergent. You have to make it neuroinclusive. And so what we're saying is that, and I'll be very bold in saying it, those that run this current curriculum, those that run the status quo, if you want this country to continue to thrive, because it's not, it's failing. Mm. We are failing as a nation. Mm. And we will continue to fail because those that, the powers that be, continue to fuck up spectacularly. We've got we had four chances of the chatter in, 6 months? Case in point. We have to replace, we have to say it's end of life now. I'm sorry. Education 3.0 is needed. We have to move it in there because that is the only way we can plug the gap. And all those young people, all those that have that hidden potential, that talent that could be unlocked if they're put into the right environments that nurture their individual potential, their abilities to create and to disrupt and to innovate and to lead. They're the ones that need to be empowered rather than those same cohort of young people being put in a bin and facilitated at school to prison pipeline.
I think this comes back to one thing then, doesn't it? Which is we're trying to change something that actually we've got a solution to change, but the actual problem actually lies in government and all forms of government. So this brings it back to a conversation about full diversity. And that means in its fullest sense. Because if you think about it, government makes sense in a stupid way. The people that go into government are people that have thrived in school environments. And they are the only people, really. There are a couple of outliers normally in, say, the Labour government where they pull people in from different backgrounds. But generally, it's the same. It's like lecturers. School lecturers are always the same sort of person because they've succeeded, right? So that means that everyone in government, regardless of their party, they have different political views, but actually they think the same way. So really, this comes back to the whole diversity conversation. We need people from different backgrounds, different races, different genders, everything, a full spectrum, because only when you have that will a different conversation happen. Exactly. And I see this in business all the time. Whenever I do my NED work, I go in and I see the same people sitting around the table. Now, they might be different races, genders, whatever they are, right? Neurodiverse, non-neurodiverse, sometimes, very rarely that is the case. But I go in there and all it is the person at the top says something and everyone goes, there's too much agreement.
It's an echo chamber, basically.
But when you have places where there's people from all backgrounds, all experiences, someone says something, you go, no, that's not right. You're actually wrong. This is what we should do. And these are the open conversations. And the problem is, without changing that, we can't change the education system. But without changing the education system, we can't get them people in. Because I am a governor of a private school. Well, it's partially private, partially government funded because it's a specialist dyslexia school, right? And I also have a private school at the end of the road, so we're very involved in that. They come and speak to us because we're residents and stuff. There is a reason why people at the top of this country come from private schools. Because when I'm in my state school, I went to what could be described as probably a prison school. It was a bloody prison school, right? We do maths, English, sciences, the standard stuff, right? But we went to an open day recently of the private school at the end of our road because I actually want my kids to go to private school. And there's a very good reason why I want her to go to a private school. They learn about economics, politics, debating. Debating is compulsory, right? All these skills that make you leave and you can go into leadership roles.
Precisely. Precisely.
So really, these are all the problems we have. And people, I mean, a lot of people go, oh, it's discussing that all politicians pretty much go to private school. It's not them. It's the result of the area they were put in, which is private school. So traditionally, wealthy people get into these positions from wealthy backgrounds because their parents have the money to send them there. But if we can change, schools so they all function the same, obviously private schools are still going to always have that little difference because of the money. But if we can change all schools where they experience different curriculum, we can change everything, right?
Well, this is why I say, you know, the constructs of society itself, it's a malevolent approach to social engineering. You know, you will, as you depicted, in these independent schools, they have, as a baseline of their curriculum, these additional components that prep you to lead or to make decisions, or both. Now, what we are saying, I mean, I'll give you some insight into my life. So, growing up, I went to a Saturday school for black children. And traditionally, in the Afro-Caribbean community, particularly in the Caribbean community, Saturday schools were created as a way to supplement a child's education with additional components of learning about black history, of learning, of having additional support in English and numeracy and sciences. And also, in the school that I was in, the school that I not only was in from the age of 5 to 16, but also came back to teach as a volunteer 3 times, one of the things that our curriculum took pride on is that if there's any professionals in the community that had a particular type of, you know, expertise or talent and so forth, they could come in and teach it. So if you had someone that had a background in electronics, we got taught electronics. If there's someone that had a background, a specialist background in politics, we got taught politics. If someone's got a specialist background in economics and business, we got taught economics and business. Whatever added value to the children now in this school, that had a freedom-like curriculum, a personalized curriculum, we gained those skills in supplement to the mainstream curriculum that we got on a Monday to Friday. So those in the school that thrive in that environment, they benefit it. I was one of them. I am the product of that environment. That's why I tell people, invest in your Saturday schools, invest in your supplementary schools, because if this curriculum is not going to adapt these additional elements of personalized learning, these, you know, I mean, this expansive curriculum to build the leaders of tomorrow, then don't wait for them and don't wait for a private school to somehow get you in for a bursary and just be the tokenism card. Empower the people in your community and teach them. Takes a village to raise a child. So that whole experience of going to supplementary school was what really influenced creating Full Spectrum the way it is, because I said to myself, I want this solution to start a revolution of a new curriculum where at some point it'll be a gig economy where if you've got a particular type of, like you've got YouTube, like you've got any type of social media platform where if you've got something to talk about or you've got a particular expertise, I can go, I can create you know, a course online that teaches you how to flip in knit clothes. I can show you how to fix cars. I can do all these things. The content is out there, but the direction of content doesn't exist. So if you then decentralize the curriculum like that and you open it up for all these people who can provide debating, you can provide finance and information management, all these things there, then you can talk to everyone. The question is now, do the powers that be want that? Because it disrupts the status quo. And it's coming to the point where now, and again, because of the sheer ineptitude of this current administration, yes, I said it, the ineptitude of the current administration shows that model has reached end of life. And those that come from those diverse backgrounds that are chocolate coloured and speak with a different type of twang like I do, they're the ones actually could actually bring this country forward into the future and actually can solve a lot of these problems. Like I said, I've taken this solution to policy advisors, said it's fucking brilliant. I said it's common sense. Case in point.
One thing you've said here, which is really important, because this is where I have a very, this is what touches me a little bit, is community. Because I'm not a religious person, right?
Neither am I.
but I believe in community. And I always say to people, I actually understand religion in that sense, creating a community around people where you can rely on people. And you keep on saying about it takes a village to raise a child.
Yep.
I couldn't agree more. And I find what the current government is doing is killing community. And actually, what you've said there is why I've been raising with people that come on the show as well, is have you gone back to your old school and talked to people about dyslexia or ADHD or stuff like that? And the thing is, a lot of people talk, but there's very little action going on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem is that, like, I do the school workshops where I go in and talk about the power of dyslexia and trying to change the narrative around dyslexia. So when they go into the workplace, they already know it's different from how it currently says it is. But a lot of people said to me, a lot of people wanted to do the same in this space for years. I've only just got into this space because of this podcast, but I've just got in here, yet I've done more than most people have who's been in it for 20 years, because there's no, they want the money first. They want to do that. And I'm like, no, you can just go in and tell your story, because inspiration is a lot of things, right?
Absolutely.
And this comes back to community. What you've just said there is so freaking obvious. And actually, as a civilization, how we've grown through hundreds and hundreds of years is transfer of skills. There's all these talented people in our communities, but the problem is the communities are disappearing. I said on the podcast recently, I've lived in roads where no one gets on. Right, I don't talk to my neighbour. He's an arsehole. He's doing this. Everyone's competing against each other. And I've just moved into this road. Now, granted, this is probably the most middle class white road you're ever going to get in your life, right? But they're all in their 70s. We are the youngest people in there.
Yeah.
But that is a community. Yeah. If anything, I need anything, advice on anything, I can go to. We've got 62 houses in the road, right? Mm-hmm. And I know everyone. How rare is that? You normally know the person to your left, your right, but no further. I need any advice in my life, I can go to them. And I think that is beautiful. Yeah. That is what we need.
Yeah.
So is that why, when we talk about community, is that why you've kind of put it all in together? It's not just the education, it's the health and welfare and all that. Is that why you...
It's the holistic approach involves the community. And I think in any type of model of financial sustainability or economic sustainability itself, it's most of the models of economics now are not based on constant aggressive growth. It's all about to thrive, right? Mm. So you can grow, but you can grow sustainably if you give back, or if you decentralize in terms of the access or the process itself to other people who are capable in doing so. If they're not capable of doing so, then give them the right tools and resources that can level the playing field. So when we're talking about the full spectrum concept, the FS1 platform, the method to the madness is this case of, okay, look, how can we use a piece of tech that can empower all to achieve? And once you go and look at that community level itself and do that level of diligence at the community level, and you build it from the bottom up or the middle out, effectively what you're doing is say, okay, look, I've had these conversations. If I was to go to someone in the community and say, you can support this child by doing X, Y, and Z. Oh, and by the way, you can support this child and it can improve, and I can actually give you access to a platform that lads get paid to do that. Mm. And then this person's paying for it. And that person's paying for it. I can go to a school and I'm like, oh, bloody hell, we haven't got a lot of budget. I don't know how we're going to pay this platform. The community pays for it. Everyone's chipping in to pay for their bit to ensure that it's sustainable. It is a decentralized funding model, and it's a decentralized operating model. So I've always been community focused in everything I do, even the business itself. You know, the model of growing a business isn't focused on just bringing on board the best and brightest, it's bringing on board the ones with the best potential, entrepreneurships. You know what I mean? All those things there, going back to this community, going back to those young people who've got all the potential and never given the platform to fulfill it, like me. So this is where, you know, anything that I say and do, I always think community first. And I think it all goes down to that whole conundrum in terms of, you know, when you build any type of tech, AI, people ask me, is this going to be the next Skynet? Is this going to be Skynet? I'm like, okay, let me tell you something. I said, look, let's look at technology in general. Okay, I've got a knife. Is this knife a weapon or is it a tool to feed you and your family? It's whatever it is based on the person who wields it. And the same thing in all types of tech, you can approach tech malevolent or benevolent. We approach this benevolent because I tell you what, we work with the community, we understand the community's concerns, and we implement their voices to ensure that this system is controlled and regulated in a way that keeps us kosher and moves things forward because it is focused on the community. So many tech companies is based on these nerds that just don't have any interaction with their environment because they just feel like they're entitled to, you know what I mean, build things based on their single point of understanding, and they go wrong. So this is why you have to approach things differently. And I said something to my team recently. I said to them, you know, as an entrepreneur, I do a lot of things in the company. Unlock me for me to be the think tank. Unlock me to be the, to me, for me to be the architect. Unlock me to be the one that goes to government and joins those boards and be the person that will challenge someone, that will tell them about themselves when they need to, but also give them radical solutions that are focused on building our society, building our nation, our growth from the community up, empowered with intelligence. That is the approach that not just me, but I implore everyone to adopt that philosophy to move us forward.
Amazing. Okay, what would you say your invisible gift is?
My invisible gift is, it's going to sound so blasé, but it's innovation. It is literally being able to lead with intelligence, you know, creating something out of nothing or improving something that exists and making it even better based on what's out there. I think that's my invisible gift is lodged up here, my intelligence.
Great. And I've got one more question for you.
Obviously.
This is, and it's going to put you on the spot a bit, but I think you've got the abilities to do it. If I could put you in front on a box in front of 10 down this street where you have the every news station in the world, what would you say to them about education? What would be the kick up the backside you would give them?
And the thing is, this is something I actually want to do.
Yeah.
I will tell them, stop fucking up our children's future. You need to listen to us and listen to people like me and allow the community to dictate what they want. You don't have the answers, we do. So it's time to change our politics. It's time to change our policies. Drive my child, his peers, the future to come to actually be great. That's what I said to him.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thank you, Andre, for coming on the show. What you guys are doing at Full Spectrum is awesome, and I'm really excited to see how it develops in the future. You can learn more about Andre and what he's doing at fullspectrum.co.uk. Next week on the podcast, I meet one of Australia's most highly regarded workplace designers, Domino Risch, to discuss what she has termed the neurodivergent workspace. In the episode, we discuss what exactly this kind of workspace is. Domino opens up about how she became interested in neurodiversity, and we discuss the future of working. It's a great show. Check it out. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. First off, make sure to subscribe to The Invisible Gift wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically be notified about new episodes. You've been listening to The Invisible Gift podcast presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kazra is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, Maisie, Jordan and Kate, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.